Good afternoon. Yesterday, momentum continued to build behind our plan to deliver massive tax relief and job creation for the American people. The House passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and the Senate Finance Committee passed its companion tax reform bill. These were important moments as we move closer to a final vote. In recent months, we've heard from American entrepreneurs, workers, and families from every corner of our nation about how this plan will empower them to build a better life. In Pennsylvania, Susie Shulman said that our plan will be, quote, incredible for me and other fixed income retirees, end quote, because tax relief is targeted at the middle class. In Ohio, Christina Port, a small business owner who raised twins as a single mother while launching her company, said the increase in the child tax credit would help working mothers. She also said simplifying the complex tax code would ease the burden on entrepreneurs and allow them to devote more of their time to growing their business rather than wrestling with their taxes. In state after state, story after story, we've heard how our plan will profoundly improve the lives of hardworking Americans. The optimism is coming back because with this tax plan, combined with the president's efforts to eliminate job-killing regulations, Americans feel like their goals are once again attainable. It's a reminder of one of the things that made our country unique to begin with. Our people have always been able to visualize a future for themselves and their children and make it a reality. That's why it's called the American Dream, and this tax plan will make it more attainable for more of our people than ever before. But for this to happen, we need economic growth that makes it possible for businesses to create jobs and raise wages. So to give some perspective on how our tax plan is going to do that, I've invited Kevin Hassett, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, to join us in the briefing today. Kevin will say a few words and then take some questions specific to this topic. And as always, I will come back up to take the rest of your questions after that, which I'm sure will all be on tax reform. So with, that, I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, and it's a pleasure to be here to see so many familiar faces. You know, last week I had the honor of chairing the Economic Policy Committee meeting at the OECD in Paris, and the Economic Policy Committee is one of the oldest committees at OECD, and it brings together people like the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from countries around the OECD. And at the meeting, they were going through the staff recommendations of the OECD for creating economic growth in countries around the world. And the three main points of the staff recommendations were tax reform, infrastructure, and deregulation, that if the government pursues those things, then they can produce more economic growth. In fact, there was widespread acclaim for the president's approach towards corporate taxation in particular, because the OECD has been calling for us to reform our corporate tax code for almost a decade. And so the idea right now that this corporate tax reform is close to the finish line is celebrated not only by us in the White House, but by people around the world who have recognized that us having a non-competitive tax code, the highest corporate tax on earth, a worldwide system that rewards companies for locating activity elsewhere, is bad not only for us, but for the world economy, because a vibrant U.S. economy is good even for our friends in the OECD. And with that, I'm pleased to see that the House Ways and Means Committee and then the House have passed this bill and that it's out of the Finance Committee, and look forward to the Senate moving forward right after the Thanksgiving break. And I guess I promise I'm not good at this. I don't know what the protocol is, but I'll start in the front row and then work back. Yeah, that's right. I'm just an economist.
Kevin, I know you're an economist, but there's obviously a political component to all of this. You've got at least six senators up on the Hill, including Ron Johnson, saying that they can't support the bill in its current form or they have serious concerns about it. You can only afford to lose two. Are you confident that you can get this passed through the Senate, or could the president run into another situation like he did with Obamacare, that he wins the House and then loses everything in the Senate?
Well, you know, there's an old joke about economists that there are three types, those who can count and those who can't. And it takes a while for that one to sink in. The fact is that the president has supported from the beginning regular order, because he doesn't think that we have to wait until the thing becomes law to learn what's in it, that the right thing to do is to expose the bills to scrutiny and debate. And Senator Johnson, I met with him yesterday in his office, has some serious concerns, and it's appropriate at this point in the legislative process to bring those forward. And you know, I'm hopeful that people can work it out and that everybody, even Democrats, will end up wanting to vote for it. And so I'm not sure about the etiquette for follow-ups. So I'll try to limit people to one, because there's a lot of hands.
Trickle-down economics is going to work this time when it hasn't worked before.
So trickle-down economics is something that, you know, I guess people who criticize the idea that taxes affect the economy will use to characterize approaches like the one that we're pursuing. But I don't think that the idea that's, you know, celebrated by even the, you know, nonpartisan staff of the OECD, that if you have lower marginal rates, you get economic growth, is voodoo economics or controversial at all. The fact is that countries around the world have cut their corporate rates and had broad-based reforms like we're doing on the individual side and then seen economic growth result. I don't think there's anybody who thinks that you'll get no growth or negative growth for this. Maybe there are a few people, but in every economic model I've seen, you get growth, either a lot of growth or sometimes, if it's a closed economy model, a little growth, but you get positive growth out of this. And that growth will benefit workers, and let's talk about that. So right now, the way a U.S. firm avoids U.S. tax is they locate activity, say, in a country like Ireland instead of here. And so if you build a plant in Ireland, then you can sell the stuff back into the U.S. And when you sell the stuff back into the U.S., then it increases the trade deficit and doesn't do anything for American workers. But it does increase the demand for Irish workers and drive up their wages. And so what the president wants to do is cut the rate to 20% and build guardrails around the tax code so that people can't transfer price everything to Ireland anymore. And if we do that, then the people who benefit will be the workers here in the U.S. who have increased demand for their jobs. I said no follow-up, so if we could help it. So I'm going to go back this way, then I'm going to switch sides. I'm sorry, I don't know everybody's name.
One of Senator Johnson's concerns is that this bill does not do enough for medium-sized and small businesses. Can you talk about what the bill does do for medium-sized and small businesses?
Sure, and the fact is that I want to remind everybody that the president has really three main non-negotiables for this bill, that there's a 20% corporate tax rate, that there's a big middle class tax cut, and that the bills simplify the tax code. And we believe, after analyzing the progress on the Hill, that both approaches satisfy the three main objectives. And so the question then is, moving forward, what do they do about pass-through entities? What do they do about this? What do they do about that? And we at the White House don't want to get ahead of that process. The president supports regular order because that's really how deals get made and how bills become law. The fact is, it's urgent that we get a 20% rate for America's workers, and it's urgent that we get a middle-class tax cut for America's workers. And the details about, like, exactly when the small business things kick in and out are things that we're watching them work out up on the Hill. And we encourage them to pursue regular order because they need to listen to everybody and get the votes they need to make this law. I'll go to the lady right there. I'm sorry.
One of the major differences between the House and Senate bill is the elimination of the non-taxable tuition waivers. So while they're trying to reconcile their differences on that tax reform bill, what do you foresee which could potentially move this tax burden to a lot of young Americans?
That's the kind of detail that we're letting Congress work out. The fact is that they're finding the coalitions that they need to pass the bills in the House and the Senate, and we support that process. We support regular order. We support the transparency that's leading debate about issues like this. Sorry, I said I'd come over here. Yeah, thank you.
Kevin, thanks for being here. On one of your TV appearances yesterday, you said that an average family, when this is all said and done, could accumulate a savings, a benefit of $4,000. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Can you walk us through that?
Sure. And for those of you, and I see some nerdy looking people out there, so I'm sure that there's people that want to do this, that we've got two CEA reports that go through this in gory detail. And the fact is that you can get to numbers like that four different ways. I won't try to do that now in the limited time that we have. But the basic idea is that back when we increased our corporate tax rate from 34% to 35%, we were kind of in the middle of the pack of OECD nations. Subsequently, what happened was the countries around the world found that when they cut the corporate tax, that their economic activity increased and the welfare of their workers improved. And then they very often did it again. A typical country, since our tax increases, cut its corporate rate two or maybe even three times. And for economists, what that does is it gives us an enormous amount of data to analyze, because there are countries that change their rate and countries that don't. And you can compare the experiences of those two types of countries. There's a big peer-reviewed literature that looks at that, including a paper by a German economist that's about to come out in the American Economic Review. And what we do is we go through all those papers and we have charts that show, well, if this paper is true, what wage effect do you get? And most of the action is well north of $4,000, and that's where the number comes from. I'll go in the middle with the orange tie.
One of the criticisms, Kevin, of the tax reform proposal is that the corporate tax rate is cut permanently. The individual tax rate phases out, after 10 years. Why, in your view, is that such a good idea?
So the president supports permanent tax cuts for the middle class and permanent tax cuts for corporations, and that's certainly the objective of the planners of this tax bill. But there are also, Senate budget rules and reconciliation rules that are required to allow this bill to move forward with 51 votes. Of course, the hope for everybody is that when the time comes for these things to expire, that they get extended, as happened, I might add, even for the top marginal rate when President Obama came into office. And so they extended most of the Bush tax cuts, but even the top rate at the beginning, which interestingly they must have done because they knew that if you were to increase the top marginal tax rate during a recession, that it would be very harmful for the economy. So back then, there was bipartisan support for the idea that you should not lift the top marginal rate. And so there should be bipartisan support. There'd be economic growth effects of bringing it down right now. I'll go back down into the middle there.
Robinson, One American News. The two bills are different in that the House bill repeals or does away with the estate tax and the Senate doesn't. And I know that was a big point for the administration, and Vice President Pence has voiced his support for repealing the death tax, as they call it. What are your thoughts on that, and do you think a final bill will include a repeal of it?
I think that, again, that's one of the things that the Senate and the House are working out. I know that the president very strongly favors the elimination of the death tax, and if that is in the final bill, I'm sure that he'll be happy about that. But he's listed his non-negotiables, and those non-negotiables I cited at the beginning. I'll go back to the far back now.
Hey, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it. Can you talk about this moment earlier in the week at the Wall Street Journal event? Gary Cohn was on stage, and the moderator asked a group of CEOs, if tax reform passes, who here is going to increase their investment? And only a couple of hands went up in the room. Gary Cohn said, why aren't there more hands going up? Can you answer that question? Why aren't there more hands going up in a room like that?
Sure,
you would assume the CEOs would say, yes, in fact, we are going to invest more if tax reform passes. Is the administration missing something there?
So that's a great question. And I went on a little bit after Gary Cohn. And when they asked that question, it was kind of hard for me because, like here, there are really bright lights, but even brighter there. And so I couldn't quite see how many hands there were. But when I was there, it looked like maybe about half the hands went up. I think if you go back and look, that it could be that people had time to think about it. But as an economist, if I go back and look at the academic literature, very often people survey CFOs and they say, hey, if we change the tax code, would you guys do anything? And they tend to always answer no in surveys. But if you look at the hard evidence about what they do, imagine if they didn't respond to taxes, then they wouldn't be pursuing their fiduciary duty to maximize profits for their shareholders. And so it would be totally irrational for them to do that. And firms that did act rationally in response to the tax code would put them out of business by taking advantage of the tax code. So the point is, the hard evidence is that people do respond. In fact, one of my very, very first papers that I ever wrote when I got out of grad school is in the Brookings papers, where we looked at the 1986 Tax Act, the changes that it made to the business tax code and how it affected investment, and there were very large effects. Right here in the front?
Yes. Gene Sperling, who was once in your position in another administration, says that this tax plan, be it historic, costs $1.5 trillion, and it's a deficit hole. And he says, it basically, this is in a tweet, just paraphrasing his tweet, he says it basically doesn't justify that cost for 100 million households for tax increase.
I respect Gene a great deal and consider him a friend, and I disagree with him about that, and I'm sure we'll at some point have a chance to talk about that. But here's the way I think about it, and what I would say to Gene if he was here, that if you look at the Joint Tax Committee score in the 10th year, they say that the tax bill costs about $170 billion. If you look at the CBO projection of GDP, then in the 10th year, GDP is about $28 trillion. And so the amount of deficit that you're talking relative to GDP in the 10th year is only 0.6%. It doesn't take a heck of a lot of economic growth to cover that hole by the 10th year. And so the idea that right now we have the highest corporate tax on earth, generating almost no revenue because people avoid the tax by moving factories to Ireland, that if we fix that, if we repair it and make the U.S. an attractive place again, that it's going to blow a hole in the deficit, it's just not economically rational. And I know that the Joint Tax Committee score says what it says, and I respect the professionalism of that staff. But the fact is that the OECD has a study, which we'd be happy to email you, that says that the U.S. in the corporate tax space is on the wrong side of the Laffer curve, that we've got such a high corporate tax rate that we're chasing business offshore and losing revenue. And so the idea that this blows a hole in the deficit, I think, is just incorrect. I'll go to Purple Tie.
John, right in front of me, left off when he asked about the phase out on the individual side. you're an economist. However, you, the two answers that you gave were both political. One, there's reconciliation rules. And two, hopefully politicians down the line solve it. But like I mentioned, you're an economist, so can you not make an economic argument as to why this is good economically for people?
Oh, is it good for things to expire?
Is there an economic argument as to why this is good for the country as it stands right now to expire within 8 years or so?
If you lower marginal tax rates, broaden the base, lower rates, give the middle class a tax cut, if you cut the corporate rate, if you do any of those things, they're positive for economic growth, and they're less positive for growth if they expire. Expensing is kind of a strange thing in the sense that if you have expensing for a year, if you go back and look at U.S. history, very often in recessions, they'll put in expensing for a year to try to stimulate the economy. When expensing expires, it could actually have a short-run stimulus because people try to buy capital before the thing goes away. But for the most part, permanent tax cuts are far more impactful than things that expire, which is why if you go back and look at the Obama administration, when they were here during the beginning of the Great Recession, they even extended the Bush tax cuts at the top because they understood this. Right, can I go right here and then I'll come to you?
Great.
And then that might be the last one because Sarah's standing.
I actually want to follow up on that.
Okay,
so
sure.
You all made a value judgment to make the corporate tax cuts permanent and make the individual tax cuts expire, even though you want all of them to be permanent. What's the rationale for having corporations have that certainty of knowing that they don't have to worry about what's going to happen in Washington while families are going to have to worry about what politicians do 6-7 years now?
Sure. Well, those are the kind of things that are being worked out by Congress in order to create a bill that under Senate and House rules can become law. And the non-negotiables for us are both met in both bills, and we consider that good news. But the choices that the Senate has to make in order to acquire a coalition to make this law are choices that the Senate has to make, and we don't want to get in front of that process.
The value, one way or the other, whether the corporate tax cuts.
I think tax cuts that are permanent, of course, will have larger positive effects. So I'll give you less.
Kevin, you've melded politics and economics here quite successfully. And I want to ask you a political and economic question. You've talked about growth covering what the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Tax Committee say could be a deficit hole, a deficit implication of $1.5 trillion. That is going to be measurable over time. There's going to be a means by which either dynamic scoring or static scoring answers that question. And since it's on the mind of some of your undecided Republican senators, is this administration willing to commit to a review 5 years in to see if the growth models have held along your lines and the deficit implications aren't as large, or if they aren't, to reassess these tax cuts in order not to blow a hole in the deficit?
I have not discussed with the president, I don't think Sarah has, what we're willing to commit to in terms of what we do 5 years from now. But I can talk, let me talk about what we can be clear about today, which is that as the president came into office, the president's opponents were saying that 2% growth was inevitable, that we were stuck in a secular stagnation, that the president's policies couldn't deliver 3% growth, and that it was a cockamamie idea to assert it. We've had two quarters in a row of 3% growth. If you look at the fourth quarter data, it's suggesting at the Atlanta Fed they have GDP now, which is about 3.2 as of yesterday. So it's saying that we're growing at 3%. If we take that momentum into next year and add a tax cut, then we're quite confident that one should be able to expect sustained growth at that level or above. And with that, I think I have to hand it back to Sarah. Thank you so much for being so gracious with your questions.
Thank you, Kevin. Major, he's right. I haven't spoken to the president about that, but I do appreciate that you know that the president will still be here in 5 years. So I like that vote of confidence that you would know that we will be here to take that review, and we'll be sure to raise that with him. We'll go back here.
Thanks, Sarah. I have a non-Roy Moore question for you. Can you say definitively, I want to ask you about the Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, can you say definitively from this podium that he has been not been held hostage by the Saudis? And does the President plan to speak to Prime Minister Hariri at all?
I'm not aware of any anticipated conversations. That's something I'd have to check on and get back to you. And I don't have any further comment beyond that at this point right now. And I would refer you to the State Department on specifics of that. Cecilia.
Thanks, Sarah. If it's fair to investigate Al Franken and the allegation made by his accuser, is it also fair to investigate this president and the allegations of sexual misconduct made
against him by more than a dozen women?
Look, I think that this was covered pretty extensively during the campaign. We addressed that then. The American people, I think, spoke very loud and clear when they elected this president.
But how is this different?
I think in one case specifically, Senator Franken has admitted wrongdoing and the president hasn't. I think that's a very clear distinction, Major.
So I want to revisit something we discussed yesterday. You said one of the ways that Alabama voters might be able to figure out if these allegations against Roy Moore are true is in the court of law. That's a direct quote from you. There's no criminal means by which that could happen. So are you suggesting that Roy Moore sue the accusers in order to hash this out in court?
That's would be something that I would refer to him to make that decision. That's not something I would be able to advise
him on.
But
that's what you meant when you talked about
in
the court
that
was of law.
One, I said that's one option, one way to determine that process, but that would be a decision that he would have to make, certainly not one I'm going to make.
Because during the campaign, as you well remember, then-candidate Trump said after the election he would sue all the women who have accused him of sexual misconduct and that you have, from the podium, deemed all liars. He hasn't done that. Why hasn't he done that?
I haven't asked him that question. I'd have to ask him and let you know why he hasn't chosen to take that path. I'm simply stating that's an option that Roy Moore has on the table. Jeff?
There are some critics have said that it was hypocritical of the president to tweet about Al Franken and not weigh in on Roy Moore.
He has weighed on Roy Moore. He did it while he was on a foreign trip in Asia. I did it repeatedly yesterday. In fact, I took about 15 questions on that topic and only one on Al Franken. So to suggest that this White House and specifically that this president hasn't weighed in is just inaccurate and wrong. He weighed in. He said if the allegations are true, he should step aside. He also weighed in when he supported the RNC's decision to withdraw resources from the state of Alabama. It's just a simply inaccurate statement to make about the president. Sarah.
Can you tell us whether the president believes the women who are making these allegations against Roy Moore, and would he be willing to ask the Alabama governor to delay the election or take a step like that to try to intervene in this electoral process in Alabama?
The president certainly finds the allegations extremely troubling, as I stated yesterday, and he feels like it's up to the governor and the state, the people in the state of Alabama to make a determination on whether or not they delay that election or whether or not they support and vote for Roy Moore. Matthew.
Thanks, Sarah. In light of the national discussion about the importance of taking these kinds of accusations seriously, I wanted to check, is it still the White House position that all the women who have accused the president of sexual misconduct are lying?
The president has spoken about this multiple times throughout the campaign and has denied all of those allegations. Blake.
Thanks, Sarah. Let me ask you about something else, the pending potential AT&T and Time Warner merger. The president had said on the campaign trail back in October 2016, and I quote here, he said, "It was a deal we will not approve in my administration because it's too much concentration of power in the hands of too few." Does the president still feel that way?
The president was asked about this a few days ago, maybe a week ago, while we were on Air Force One, and I'd refer you back to those comments. April.
Sarah, is this an uncomfortable conversation about these sexual allegations for this White House, be it Al Franken or be it Roy Moore?
I think it's an uncomfortable conversation for the country. I think that this is something that is being discussed pretty widely, and we certainly think that it should be taken very seriously, and it's one of the reasons I stand up here and answer your questions every day, and will continue to do so and continue to address them. Obviously, it's something that should be looked at, and I think it should be looked at widespread, not just in the political sphere, but in the business atmosphere and across the board in this country, and something we certainly, again, take seriously. Alex,
I talked to Hillary Clinton today
April.
About the president's past, and going back to what Matthew said, she said, look, I worry about everything from his past because it tells you how he behaves in the present and will in the future. What do you say to that as it relates to these allegations against the president?
I think Hillary Clinton probably should have dealt with some of those of her own issues before addressing this president. Alex.
Two questions, one on taxes, the other on immigration. A recent Quinnipiac University poll said 61% of voters think the Republican tax plan will benefit the wealthy. Well, the White House has pitched this plan as a working class tax cut. Why the disconnect? And then on immigration.
Let me answer that first question.
Okay.
Look, we've actually argued that this tax plan benefits all Americans. That's the point of it. Specifically, in our priority is to target middle-class Americans and make sure that that is addressed first and that those people are prioritized in any piece of legislation first, either the House or the Senate. But at the same time, we want all Americans to benefit by a growing economy and a tax system that actually works for our country versus one that penalizes people. We're going to keep moving just because we're tight. John?
Let me come back and ask you the same thing I asked Kevin. You've got six Republican senators either no or seriously on the fence here. Can you win enough over in order to pass this? And if the president gets snookered again by the Senate, what's his reaction going to be?
We certainly are still very confident that we're going to get this package passed, and we'd love to see some of the Democrats come on board and support this historic piece of legislation that we feel will be one of the great legacies of this presidency.
The fact that you didn't get any Democrats in the House, how does that pertain for getting them in the Senate?
There's always hope. We'll hold out hope that Democrats in the Senate want to put partisan politics aside and put the people of this country first. We haven't ruled it out, and we're certainly going to keep pushing forward, and we're still confident we're going to get it done.
It's safe to say the president will not be pleased if he gets snookered by the Senate again?
I think the American people will be the ones that won't be pleased, because they're going to be the ones that lose out the most if this doesn't go forward. Talib.
Thanks, Sarah. The administration put out a disaster funding request for about $44 billion today. It's much less than what a number of different governors and officials in the various impacted territories and states have requested. Can you explain sort of why the number is so low compared to what the local officials say they need?
I don't think $44 billion is a low amount. And my guess is if you ask any average citizen across this country, they wouldn't feel like it's low either. Up until this point, Texas has not put any state dollars into this process. We feel strongly that they should step up and play a role and work with the federal government in this process. We did a thorough assessment, and that was completed, and this was the number that we put forward to Congress today.
More requests forward in the future, specifically for Puerto Rico.
Absolutely. At this point, the request that went in today of the roughly $44 billion primarily addresses Texas and Florida. Those storms took place ahead of Puerto Rico, and the assessment for Puerto Rico hasn't been completed yet. Once that's done, we fully anticipate that there will be additional requests at that time. Kristen?
Thank you. Steve Bannon is sending a strong message to the establishment to back off of Roy Moore. Is the president's allegiance to Steve Bannon in any way impacting his response?
The president doesn't have an allegiance to Steve Bannon. The president has an allegiance to the people of this country and nothing else.
Has he spoken at all to Steve Bannon or any outside advisors?
Not that I'm aware of.
How concerned is he, Sarah, about losing this seat to the Democratic candidate, who right now, according to the polls, is leading?
Look, I think that the president is less concerned about the seat and more focused on the policy and the legislation that we're pushing through right now, like tax reform. John?
In regards to that question regarding the supplemental request the president and the administration has put forward, $44 billion. Puerto Rico has requested $94 billion. Are they going to get somewhere along that order? I think half of the island is still without electricity.
As I said, we're going to wait until that assessment is complete, and we'll make a determination at that point and see what the best path forward is.
Did the president notify Governor Abbott of the lesser amount that he's put forward?
John, I'm going to keep moving. I'm going to try to be respectful of your colleagues. Go ahead.
Yesterday, the joint investigative mechanism was vetoed by Russia at the UN Security Council, and Ambassador Haley tweeted afterward that the veto proves that Russia cannot be trusted as a partner going forward in trying to solve the political situation in Syria. Does the president have any response to the veto first? What is the U.S. view going forward of how chemical weapons will be investigated and dealt with in Syria? And is it the U.S. position now that Russia cannot be a partner in trying to solve or do a next day
political situation.
I think by the actions that the president's taken, specific to chemical weapons, I think he's shown his position on that with the strike in Syria earlier this year. In terms of Russia's veto, it's certainly not one we support. We do hope that moving forward, they want to get on board and work with us on this. But at the same time, this isn't something that we support their decision on. Stephen?
There's been some extraordinary pushback on the administration's decisions with respect to elephant trophies and hunting of lions and elephants in Africa. Can you shed some light on the decisions the administration has made and what you make of the pushback?
Yeah, this is actually due to a review that started back in 2014 under the previous administration, done by career officials at the Fish and Wildlife Service. This review established that both Zambia and Zimbabwe had met new standards, strict international conservation standards, that allowed Americans to resume hunting in those countries. A ban on importing elephant ivory from all countries remains in place. But again, all of this was based on a study that was conducted that started back to the previous administration and done by career officials. Darlene?
The Senate tax bill has a tax break for corporate jets. How does that help the middle class?
As Kevin stated before, this administration has laid out the priorities that we want to see reflected in this legislation. We're going to continue to fight for those priorities and let the legislative process work through in terms of those specific pieces. That's something I would refer you to members of the House and Senate on that. But our focus is on making sure these priorities are answered and met. We'll make this the last one.
Yesterday on Jared Kushner and those campaign emails, that Senate committee, they're asking for those emails in the Russia investigation. You punt it to the Kushner's attorney. Today, what's the White House reaction to those previously undisclosed emails?
Look, that as I said, they were going to put out a statement. They did, and I would refer you back to that on anything specific to that inquiry. Thanks so much, guys. Hope you have a happy Friday and a good weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And welcome to Press TV's debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, is Zimbabwe about to enter another direction after the detention of President Robert Mugabe earlier this week? The military took over important government ministries and detained the president along with his wife, Grace. Now, the military says this is not a coup and has given Mugabe a date to step down. Most analysts say otherwise. Is this the end of Mugabe's rule in Zimbabwe or not? And what does it all mean? Stay with us as we zoom in on these recent developments in Zimbabwe on this debate.
No results following nearly a week of political freefall in Zimbabwe. This time again, thousands of people pour onto the streets of the capital, Harare, to demand an immediate resignation of President Robert Mugabe. Meanwhile, Mugabe's nephew and a member of the ruling party has accused the military of engineering popular demonstrations to, quote, disguise its coup. He, however, said Mugabe had no intention of stepping down, adding that Mugabe and his wife were ready to die for what is correct and would never battle what observers believe to be a military coup.
I think it most definitely is a coup. I mean, if you send the military in to essentially apprehend the president and then say he either agrees to some reforms or he'll be removed as president is frankly a coup.
The army, however, rejects allegations of orchestrating a putsch, stressing that it only intended to target criminals around Mugabe when military forces and tanks rolled into the streets on November the 14th. Several senior officials were taken into custody, and many others fled the country. A source close to Mugabe says the 93-year-old president is reluctant to step down after nearly four decades in office. but Zimbabwe's ruling party says it will impeach the embattled president if he refuses to give up power. Zimbabwe's political pandemonium broke out last week after Mugabe sacked his longtime deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who had the support of the military, prompting fears that he would finally position his wife, Grace, to succeed him. Mr. Mnangagwa is a veteran of the liberation group that fought for independence in 1980. The Zimbabwean president has dominated the country's politics since it gained independence from the UK in 1980. Mugabe fought for his country's independence from a colonial power before becoming its leader. For years, calls for his resignation have been inconceivable, but the army's overnight gamble can be a dramatic end to the veteran ruler's reign.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, adjunct professor of history from Megger Everts College, Mr. Jahi Issa, out of New York, and African affairs expert, Mr. Ayo Johnson, out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in London. Ayo Johnson, so what exactly happened on Tuesday? Has there been a coup or has there not been a coup in Zimbabwe?
Well, it's a soft coup, as I would call it. I mean, clearly, Mr. Mugabe had his power drained out of him. Clearly, the apparatus that governs government were put on hold by the military. But Mr. Mugabe has fought back. He has shown a great degree of poise. You could see some of the pictures that came out showing him meeting some of the generals in his living room. You could see a relaxed Mugabe. We saw further pictures which showed him with the military generals laughing. These were all signs that this was a Mugabe who was clearly not going to stand down, clearly willing to negotiate his way out of trouble, and of course this would be his largest and biggest fight to date. No doubt about that.
All right. Well, what about it, Mr. Issa? Do you think that Robert Mugabe will step down or not? It seems on the one hand he has been given an ultimatum by the military, but it does seem to be an odd sort of coup. Your take?
Well, it's Dr. Jahi Issa. Two, I would have to disagree with Mr. Johnson. It's not a coup. The Zimbabwean Constitution has a provision within it that states that the military can step in if issues of national security are concerned. Now, the ruling party has accused Mr. Mugabe of really not being capable of running the government. His wife has ran the government. Another major concern that is not just the military, it's the ruling party. It's also the very powerful veterans associations. Many of these men and women who fought for their independence, fought against the Ian Smith racist white supremacist regime. And so they saw that the wife, who was not a veteran of the war, was causing many problems. Her sons were living this lavish lifestyle at the expense of a crumbling economy. Billions of dollars of diamond money has ended up missing. And we see the great elder statesman, Dr. Robert Mugabe, falling asleep quite often doing public official affairs.
So Dr. Issa,
So Dr. Issa,
if I'm understanding what you're saying, so basically you're saying that it was not a coup, and basically the veterans, the revolutionaries from the past saw no choice but to take it over. As the military spokesman said when this happened on Tuesday, he said it's not a coup, but it is to weed out corruption in the government. That's what you're saying, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. A lot of corruption. And a lot of this can be easily blamed on his wife, but mostly on Mr. Mugabe himself, who is basically not capable of running the country in his ripe senior age.
Okay, what about that, Aya Johnson? Stay with me, Dr. Issa. What about that, Aya Johnson? That it's actually for the benefit of the country because Mugabe was no longer capable or aware, perhaps, of what exactly was being done. Do you see this possibly as something in order to actually weed out corruption, as the military spokesman said?
Well, one thing for sure is that President Mugabe's antics, as people have described him as old, frail, or unable to govern, I think that's suspect. I think he clearly had his hands on the pulse, because when this so-called soft coup, or this so-called whatever it is people want to call it, when this happened, clearly you could see President Mugabe on his own negotiating. Clearly, if he didn't have his wits around him, if he didn't have his faculties in checked, he wouldn't be able to do so and retain power currently. I think what we have now is a situation where the military cannot be perceived to have been a coup, because the international response would be naturally coups are shied on, not respected, and not endorsed. There lies the problem, which is why we're having a lot of people demonstrating today on the streets in Zimbabwe, and endorsed to an extent by the military, because they are hoping within elements of the ZANU-PF to have a popular uprising. They're hoping that the transformation of the military would be upheld and pushed by the people. That remains to be seen. So in terms of Mr. Mugabe being old, yes, he is, but he's far from the reality that he's incapable of managing the Zimbabwean affairs. Yes, to an extent, a large proportion of the elements of governance which were associated with the presidential rule had been gone by other people behind the scenes. No doubt about that. There's a limit to what a 90-year-old man can do on a day-to-day basis. But in terms of managing, I think Mr. Mugabe clearly has shown previously and currently right now that he's got his hands firmly on the pulse.
Okay, well, stay with me, Dr. Issa, Mr. Johnson. Let's cross over to our Facebook page and see what some of our viewers have had to say on this subject.
Should the African Union allow military juntas to stage a coup in Zimbabwe, then it should get ready for more coups in other democracies elsewhere where it is not performing. The army needs respect because they didn't do anything to him except to detain the president at his residence. I don't know whether that building belongs to him or the state. Slowly, as the father of the nation, he has forgotten to lead 15 million Zimbabweans' collapse of economy. Most of African leaders are like Mugabe. Take the example of Museveni of Uganda, Bashir of Sudan, Uhuru Kenyatta, and many more. The best thing for New Zimbabwe is to seize Mugabe's property in Malaysia, Singapore, the UK, and South Africa. The most African dictators never hand over their power unless they face a coup or die. So the only solution is either of the two. But by no means the military can take the power. They should pave the way for people to elect their civilian leadership and return back to their duty, which is safeguarding their country and the stability of their people. Mugabe deserves some respect from Zimbabweans despite his latest blunders. This oldie should vacate the seat of power and retire peacefully, or else he will be ousted like Gbagbo. They voted him into office on a 5-year term while they knew that he is old. Today they tell him go out because you are old. Does this make sense? Please hand over João back to us. He knows very well that the G4T was stealing, knowing that their criminal activities will be fully backed by SADC. Mugabe to resign? Why not before? I would love Mugabe to continue. The thing to consider most is what will happen after him. President Robert Mugabe is still the head of state and government of Zimbabwe and commander-in-chief of our defense forces. There was no coup. He will not be removed unconstitutionally, but due process will be followed. Already, both the ZANU-PF party and country's constitution are being followed, as witnessed by the decision by the party's 10 provinces to remove and recall him as both party and country's president. The party's central committee will hold a meeting tomorrow to make the final decision. On Tuesday, Parliament will most likely hold impeachment proceedings on removing Mugabe as a state president. This is all in accordance with the constitutions of both ZANU-PF and Zimbabwe. From my political perspective, Mugabe deserves respect. If Zimbabweans wanted to oust him, they could have chosen a different method, not a coup. This is Africa, and I see filthy hands involved in this coup, especially the US and the UK, who orchestrated this coup. They are the ones who gave a blank check to the army, giving them a green light to go on Mugabe's regime that has been a long irritant to the West after liberating hectares of land from the white settlers.
Well, we had lots of comments. I'd like to thank our viewers in Africa. Actually, we had so many more, and obviously we couldn't use all of them. We appreciate our viewers engaging in this topic. Dr. Issa, one of the comments basically said, well, if it's because of his age, and they had elections, he was elected to another five-year term. Well, he was already old to begin with, so if age is really a factor, wouldn't that figure into it all? And they feel that something else is behind this. Your take, sir.
Yes, well, the wife convinced the elder statesman to sack his longtime vice president and good friend, and he went into exile. He was a war veteran, as your commentary stated in the beginning. That was a soft coup, right? And I think the leaders of the ruling party, along with the military, are looking at what could possibly happen as far as the West encroaching in and possibly destroying the revolution, retaking the lands, and all the efforts that were gained after the Revolutionary War to free the country. And I think they felt that they had no other recourse but to go in, talk to Mr. Mugabe, President Mugabe, and as it stands now, it looks like he's going to be forced to resign. Mm-hmm. His wife should not be allowed to be the president of the country, because many of the veterans, as I stated earlier, they've already stated that they want someone who has an understanding of how the country was won. And if you bring in all of these people, like the wife had an organization called the G40. It was her own mafia, in which it was she brought turmoil on many of the former politicians, mm-hmm. including the VP, who's now in exile.
Okay. What about that, Mr. Johnson? How do you see it at this point in time? Because we have some people saying, what now? I mean, Dr. Issa is basically saying that the military had to get involved to make sure, for example, that the West does not interfere afterwards and it goes in the right direction. But many would say that perhaps this has been done with the okay from certain Western former imperialist powers. How do you see it?
Well, one thing is quite clear is that the ZANU-PF party, which has been in existence since Zimbabwe achieved its independence under Mugabe, clearly is here to stay. As far as the ZANU-PF party is concerned, this is an internal struggle. This is a struggle between old versus young, new versus old. Clearly, the president's wife had a good affiliation with the younger elements within the party, as opposed to Mr. Mugabe's deputy, who had very hard-lined military credentials with some of the elder statesmen in the party. And there is the struggle. So this struggle between old versus new is one for the ZANU-PF. It doesn't involve the MDC, it doesn't involve any other political party. And of course, what's quite clear is that the ZANU-PF party would not kill its own survival at the expense of this so-called soft coup. If it realizes for an instance that its own position will be compromised, if at all ZANU-PF were to go head-to-head with MDC in an election, which was then endorsed by the West, I think ZANU-PF would clearly not want that to happen. So I think this internal struggle will be addressed. As to whether Mr. Mugabe would survive or not remains to be seen. If it does, it wouldn't surprise me for him to continue leading the ZANU-PF party until such a time that they think it's right for him to stand down, as long as the elder statesmen within the party have the confidence that their positions would not be affected. But on the ground right now, the momentum with the people who are demonstrating on the ground, with some of the efforts that we've seen and heard across the country from ZANU-PF elements, the struggle continues, and this struggle between young versus old remains to be seen who would exactly win that.
Okay, well, what about that, Dr. Issa? Your perspective, what happens now?
I want to say this. I want to...
Go ahead.
Well, I want to interject very quickly and say that the ZANU-PF party, the youth wing, has voted for Mr. Mugabe to go. So when we say this is an issue of young versus old, that's not necessarily true. The youth wing have voted for Mr. Mugabe to go, along with the senior veterans of the party. So that is majority rules. That is within the Constitution. In many of the regional party branches throughout the country, they've all unanimously voted. Now it has to be sent to Parliament, in which Parliament would vote for Mr. Mugabe to step down, and that the new vice president be brought in for 90 days, and then a new election will occur, right? But I think this is all important, not only for Zimbabwe itself, but for the security of all of Southern Africa. And this is a warning to many of the military, many of the dictators throughout Africa. Because if we want to talk about dictatorship, we look at other countries, like we said, Uganda, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea. Many of these countries have long-serving presidents that don't benefit the people. But here, the central issue is that Zimbabwe, under President Robert Mugabe, successfully took the land back and gave it back to the people. This is why the media, the Western media particularly, is making a big issue out of this.
Mr. Issa, your perspective, sir. What happens now if Mugabe is removed? Tell me likely direction of Zimbabwe in your perspective.
If Mugabe is moved, Zimbabwe will be a shining light for the entire world. Everybody knows that the African continent is the future of the world, period. And everybody is looking at Zimbabwe. Everyone is looking at it. It is best for Mr. Mugabe and his family to step aside and let democracy take place, without his wife interfering in with the national security issues of the country and the entire region. Even South Africa and many of the other envoys have already supported what's going on with the ruling party.
Okay, stay with me, Dr. Issa. Your thoughts, Mr. Johnson. Prognosis, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that what your guest is talking about there, I don't necessarily agree with everything, because one thing for sure is that the Zimbabwean people will decide what happens to Zimbabwe ultimately. And of course, the army would also decide. But crucially, it's the international world. As we stand and sit here today, the rest of the West would not want any form of ZANU-PF, be it with Mugabe or any other person, to be in power. As far as they're concerned, MDC and Tsvangirai would always be their man. There lies the problem. So moving forward, it doesn't matter whether Mr. Mugabe is gone or he stays. The fact that ZANU-PF party would remain in power, which is exactly what I'm expecting will happen, the West would continue applying those sanctions. The West will continue to speak ill of Zimbabwe. And as far as I'm concerned, the relationship with Zimbabwe and the West would continue to be exactly the same, no different, until such a time that MDC can make its way to power, if that ever happens.
All right, and on that note, I'd like to thank both my guests for being with me, adjunct professor of history out of Megar Evers College, Dr. Jahi Issa out of New York, and African affairs expert, Mr. Ayo Johnson, out of London. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another debate right here at Press TV. While Marzia Hashimi signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much, and see you next time.